So good afternoon and good morning. I am Chris Lucas. I'm the Technical Assistance Specialist for AOA's ADDGS Resource Center. With us on the phone today, we're going to be discussing sustainability with Romain Turin, who's the Project Director of the Bureau of Elder and Adult Services from the Maine Department of Human Services, and Carissa Derrance from the Alzheimer's Program Consultant of the Division of Aging, North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Also is Diane Bronstein, who's the Director of Technical Assistance here at the AOA's ADDGS National Resource Center, and Lori Stahlbaum, who is the Program Officer for the ADDGS Program, and as you all know, from the U.S. Administration on Aging. I'd also like to offer just a brief aside, an apology for the technical glitches that we found when we tried to send out the information on the conference calls. I understand it was incredibly short notice, so I appreciate everyone's efforts to be available. You'll be pleased to know that all of those glitches have been resolved, and that should not be a problem in the future, and you can expect all future teleconference information to be announced over the listserv in the future. So with that is my welcome and introduction. As I said, we will be discussing sustainability with Romain and Carissa, and all of you. We're going to ask that Romain and Carissa have a chance to make their presentations, and we'll finish off with a general discussion and questions for Romain and Carissa. But first, I know that Lori and Diane have a little welcome of their own, so I would invite Diane to begin.
Okay. Well, just on behalf of the Resource Center, I want to say thank you for taking time out of your busy day today. And although I would just share with you that this is actually the third teleconference in our series of planned teleconferences, we had two in April that were for the potential grantees, since the subject of those teleconferences was basically the 2005 grant announcement for people who will be applying under those grants. So for the rest of you, I'm very pleased, even though this is the third in the series, this is the first of our teleconferences that will continue on during the summer on subjects that some of you took the time to vote on in terms of teleconferences for the grantees. So welcome and hello.
Lori?
Hi, this is Lori Stahlbaum, Program Officer. thanks, everybody. I'm ecstatic about starting up with these teleconferences, and the Resource Center folks have done a great job of trying to identify topics that would be useful. A lot of it based on things that came out of last year's annual grantee meeting and just their knowledge in the field. And, I will hopefully be drawing a lot of resources from within the program. And I just am really, really excited about it. Like, you know, I always am. And I want to say that it is our intent, talking about the series of teleconferences, it is our intent to try to hold these teleconferences almost monthly. They'll really be about 8 a year. I think right now they'll be a few more like monthly almost. But anyway, it's the goal to try to keep them consistent to the third Wednesday of a month at 2 o'clock Eastern time. This particular one got out of whack because I had to do a presentation. And so just sort of for the back of your mind, we are going to try to set it up on a more consistent monthly schedule as we go along. So hopefully, aside from the glitches, you know, it's something that can kind of become a regular thing that you can know is going to take place. So, Romain and Carissa, thanks so much, and I look forward to hearing your presentation now.
Okay. Well, in that vein, I'd like to ask if Romain and Carissa, beginning with Romain, could just take a moment to give us a brief description of their project and let us know the importance and description of some of their key partners. So, Romain, can you just take 5 minutes or so?
Sure. I apologize to those who have heard this before, but I'll try to make it sound distinct and different. Maine has been pretty fortunate because we've been a recipient of this grant all along, so we've kind of evolved our program. The grant used to really kind of fund model projects and that we would do in small areas of the state, but now it's much more of a systemic kind of program that we've developed. in Maine on a statewide basis. And our overall goal, I think you probably all got a copy of this, was to use the funds to increase access to an array of services provided to caregivers of people with Alzheimer's disease in rural Maine in two major ways. So our whole focus is really on getting and supporting caregivers. The first use of our funds is to really support the home care program by supporting caregivers of people who are receiving home care. Maine has really moved to a very well developed home care program, where we've actually reduced the size of the number of people in nursing homes and reduced the number of nursing home beds and are serving them at home. And so we've got a statewide system of assessing people's needs and assessing which program they're eligible for. So at that time of assessment, the assessing agency looks at the services that are provided by the informal care system, by family members, and then builds a care plan around what's already provided. And that's a care plan that's funded by either state or federal funds, depending on what they're eligible for. And so what we did was we looked at developing a pilot project that really looked at supporting the caregivers, because the system is based on what the caregivers provide. It doesn't really look at what the caregiver needs. So we've developed a caregiver companion program that really looks and supports the caregiver of people who are receiving, of people with dementia who are receiving home care. And the companions go to the home, they meet with the caregiver, they just kind of, they're not licensed people, but they're people who have been caregivers themselves, and they, you know, they provide information, they provide education, they provide support, they provide, they go on outings together with the caregiver, they don't provide respite, but they provide companionship. And so we've spread that out now to 11 counties. You know, some of the things we found are that, you know, the caregivers haven't been out of the house in years, because they just have had, you know, they just haven't known how to take a person with dementia out of the house, so they kind of model behavior, or they do gardening together, or they do whatever, provide a lot of information and a lot of support. The other thing that we're doing with the Caregiver Companion Program, you know, with this new grant, is that we're using the old intake forms that were developed by AOA, we're identifying caregivers who have mental health needs, in particular depression, and we've put money aside for services so that referrals can be made to mental health, you know, specialized mental health services for caregivers to try to get them into some kind of supportive counseling situation. And we really based that on some of the literature that was suggested we use. I think we used some of Schultz's work to look at what works in terms of mental health counseling. And so we've put funds aside to fund at least three sessions of counseling for caregivers to support them. The other thing we're doing is we've had, through grant funds, we've developed a statewide respite program that's now funded by the state. And that respite program provides up to $3,800 a year to caregivers to provide respite in-home or at a daycare program or overnight. Over time, the area agencies on aging administer that respite program. They've identified also the need for mental health support for the caregivers who are identified as depressed. So they're all developing little models on how to best provide mental health services to caregivers. So we're in the process of developing that. And then with both programs, we've kind of moved ahead a little bit, and we're trying to provide some end-of-life palliative and hospice referral services to those people receiving home care or who are receiving services from the Area Agency on Aging. We've got this well-developed home care program. A lot of people die at home, but yet they've had no end-of-life care or hospice at all. So we're just kind of moving into that area. So that's kind of in a nutshell. I think, you know, our partners are really with the university. I work for the university to help evaluate it. We're working with the Maine Hospice Council and the Maine Alzheimer's Association. You know, hospice agencies we've never worked with before, and area agencies on aging, mental health service providers. So pretty broad range of stakeholders.
Okay. Thank you, Romaine. Carissa, can you give us a quick project description and information on your partners?
Sure. In North Carolina, we have Project CARE. CARE standing for Caregiver Alternatives to Running on Empty. It is a respite program. It began in 2001, and in July 2004, we received a second grant from the Alzheimer's Demonstration Program to expand and enhance Project CARE in North Carolina. The purpose of the program to access or to increase access, choice, use, and quality of dementia-specific respite care. We also are trying to create a seamless system that's coordinated, dementia-friendly, and just overall trying to make the service system in North Carolina more responsive to Alzheimer's families. The targeted population is low-income, rural, and minorities. We selected areas of the state that were previously underserved and really needed some intervention. With the new grant, we expanded the target area from 6 counties to 10 counties, and we added 4 counties that were very rural and had very few resources. The way that Project CARE is structured, we have 3 program sites. 2 are based out of the Alzheimer's Association. 1 is based out of a county Department of Social Services. And we use a family consultant model, so we have a family consultant set up in each of these program sites. That's really one of the most essential elements of our program, is having that family consultant in place. And probably the other most important element of the program is the in-home assessment. The family consultant goes into the homes and does a holistic, family-centered assessment and trying to find out, what the family needs from respite to a whole range of different services, training, education, counseling. It's very individualized from family to family. And the family consultant uses existing programs and services. So we're not duplicating what's already out there. We're connecting families with programs and services that are in the community that they may not be aware of, or they simply don't have the energy to investigate and find out, how they can access these resources. So, in doing that, we can really meet a lot of needs of the families. We provide respite care, different supplemental services, and this really maximizes the funding that we have. Some of the families that the family consultants visit will be enrolled in Project CARE and will receive respite, and others will receive consultation and may be connected to a different program that they qualify for that they didn't know of previously. Each family that is enrolled in Project CARE receives funding up to $2,000 a year, and they can spend it spread out throughout the whole year, or they can spend it all in 1 month. Whatever their needs are at that given time, they have the choice to spend it the way they need to. They can choose between adult day services, in-home care, residential or institutional respite. And with a new grant, we're piloting an additional respite option in the 4 new counties of letting families hire somebody privately, whether it's a family member, friend, neighbor, and that's really because those 4 counties have such few resources that may be their only hope in getting respite. The key components for Project CARE is dementia-specific, relying on the expertise of the family consultants, by being supported by the Alzheimer's Association and Duke Family Support Program, and it really provides a lot of training and educational resources for families, providers, and other participants in the community. It's consumer-directed, as I said. They can choose what kind of respite they want. They can select, the duration and frequency, and the family consultants will provide case management services really based on what the family's needs and preferences are. Some people want to do most of it themselves. Others prefer to have the family consultant do most of the coordinating, so it just depends on each situation. The program is very flexible. It can be based in different settings in the community, depending on what the strengths are in that service area. You know, we have a real strong Alzheimer's Association in North Carolina, so it works well there, but it also works really well in the County Department of Social Service. And another way that the program is flexible is just the eligibility. We try to make it as simple as possible and so that the family consultants can get these families their services as quickly as possible. It's a portal to, if people come out for the respite, and they can be connected to, you know, a whole array of different services. I think sometimes families, you know, wouldn't access these services otherwise. They come out for the respite relief, and then they're able to gain perspective and recognize their other needs, and then they can are willing, you know, to try new things. And just in general, I think the one of the surprising impacts that we have seen is just the way that this program strengthens the community, it unifies the community, and all the participating agencies and programs, and we're flowing back and forth, we're sharing information and resources, it's increasing awareness, it's just, there's a whole kind of ripple effect that we've seen, and it's been really great. The key partners for this program, the foundation of the program was really in the North Carolina Alzheimer's Support Program, which consists of the Duke Family Support Program and the Alzheimer's Association chapters. And, you know, the Division of Aging and Adult Services, we receive the funds and we, you know, work through the Western Carolina Alzheimer's Association and Mecklenburg County Department of Social Services. They're the ones who are actually implementing the program at the local level, and we receive technical assistance through Duke Family Support Program with Lisa Gleitzer being just an invaluable resource to us. And some of the new partnerships that we've developed through the new grant has been, you know, we've continued our partnership with the Family Caregiver Program, which has been very successful. We've added two programs through the Real Choice Systems Change Grant, which is the Consumer Directed Care Work Group that kind of advises us with our private respite pilot, and the Direct Care Workers Association, which kind of increases our resources for providers in providing training and support, and the Aging Disability Resource Center. Just that's kind of in its peak of evolving right now, so our partnership with that project will be increasing a lot over the next year or two. So that is it in a nutshell, I think.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. And so now we're going to throw it back to Romaine. And Romaine, if you can give us some lessons learned from your adventures in sustainability.
Well, I think one of the things we kind of have done is set back and kind of look at the systems in Maine and how they can be improved for people who have dementia and or their caregivers. So I think that's been very helpful in building projects and probably also in sustaining them, in that we haven't spent a lot of time developing programs and implementing them that are standalone. We've kind of looked at systems that already exist and kind of worked with them and kind of built and added on to what has already been done based upon conversations that people have had. So, for example, looking at the home care program, we didn't develop a home care program. I mean, one of the clear goals in Maine was not to develop separate standalone systems, because it's just a waste of time. But if you look at the home care program, there are so many people being served who have some sort of dementia that it just made sense to add a program onto that program. I don't know if that's being clear or not, but. And at first, there were some things to overcome. I mean, there were some issues about, why are we doing this for just people who have Alzheimer's or related dementia? Why can't we do this for all caregivers? And, you know, you kind of have to work through those issues. I mean, at first, you know, you can give them just the demographics that they're, you know, of the home care system, X percent are people who have dementia. And then, you know, you have to kind of just settle in and say, well, that's what the grant is for. You know, it's really a grant that's designed for caregivers or for people who have dementia. It's an Alzheimer's disease demonstration grant. And I think that when you work with people who are already working with older people in general, they've already identified at this point that people who have a dementia have different needs, or their caregivers are more burdened or more depressed or more stressed. So you kind of have gotten to the point where people are really welcoming the added help. So I think the other thing that we've done is we have worked with, like, one of our Real Choices grants in Maine, similar to what's going on in North Carolina, is a direct care workforce demonstration. And we've worked with them, and we've looked at how we can support that effort that's going on. And in the little write-up I mentioned, that what we're doing is actually paying a stipend for direct care workers to be trained in dementia care. So many people who work for home health agencies or even the homemaker agencies in Maine, when they go to a training, they're paid to go. You know, they get their regular salary and they go to a day of training. Some of our direct care workers or our personal care attendants don't, I mean, if they go to a training, they don't get paid because it's a loss of a day of work. So what we decided to do was give them a stipend, which would kind of offset their loss of pay. And then we've also tried to work with the Direct Care Workforce Coalition to help them develop their website and then give special demarcation or recognition to people who have been trained in dementia care. So if people want to go to that website and look for a direct care worker, they'll be able to identify somebody who's had special training. So I think that's kind of been our approach. And then I think once we've you know, worked and provided services and kind of demonstrated that things are working, it's much easier to get the state buy-in because they've already seen kind of the success of it. You know, I think Maine, like many other states, have been going through economic hardships and budget cuts and all of that. And I think when they see kind of me coming, or they see the Alzheimer's Demonstration Grant Program coming, they see it as something that has some resources to give, which is so refreshing because everybody else is cutting and trying to do more with less. And it's just been very refreshing to be able to have some resources that can give to a program that really helps them. It helps other programs better meet the needs of people that they're serving.
Okay. Thank you, Romain.
Do you want me to go on, or do you want to do that?
Yes. If you have more to elaborate on, please do.
Well, I mean, I could just. No, I think I'll just stay there.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Carissa, would you like to continue?
Yeah, actually, I'm glad I have a few extra minutes. I was worried about putting in the time.
Okay, take your time.
You know, with Project CARE, I was trying to come up with some key steps to sustainability based on what Diane had wanted for this teleconference. And I know, I mean, when we had talked earlier, you know, it's so different from state to state that I think that hopefully some people can pull a little bit out of North Carolina's experience and a little bit out of Maine's and kind of find things that will benefit your individual program. So, you know, what works for North Carolina won't work for everyone, but I wanted to at least go over the success that we've had here. And with Project CARE, I think the most important piece of the program is the role of the family consultant. I mean, I don't think we would have succeeded if we didn't have those people in place. And what's kind of unique about the family consultant is their neutral role. They're going into the family's homes, and they're not they're not a vendor. They're not being competitive or trying to promote a certain service. They're going in as a family advocate, promoting the caregiver needs, focusing on meeting the needs of the whole family, and they assess the eligibility for all available programs and resources, not just Project CARE, but they're very knowledgeable about what is going on in the community, and they can connect them with anything that they can that they're eligible to receive. And sometimes, as I said before, we may enroll them in Project CARE and provide respite and counseling and training through Project CARE, but in other cases, we're referring them to other programs that can meet their needs that they just weren't aware of. The in-home perspective that the family consultants have is invaluable. They're able to get a realistic picture of what's going on, and not only with needs such as respite or education, they can look at the environment and identify any safety concerns that the family may need to address. And it's just a way of really identifying what's going on and making sure that all of their needs are met as much as possible. And on that same note, the family consultants, their intervention is comprehensive. They try to provide them with as many services as they can. That's one of the things we try to do with the new grant, and one of the enhancements was to try to go beyond Project CARE and see what else was out there in the community that we could connect them with. And so we've tried to put a lot of effort into that. And just the family consultant being the direct link from the family to the Alzheimer's chapter and other programs like the Family Caregiver Program, it's just been key. These families are so isolated and they don't get out of their house that if family consultants weren't going into their homes and being that link, they would not get the help that they needed. I think when Diane came down last February, she had to give her credit for the term barrier buster, but we see the family consultants as being a barrier buster, and just different areas that they've been able to be successful is, with the families experiencing guilt, and they feel like they should be able to provide this care by themselves, and if there's something wrong with them, if they can't do it alone. And the family consultants come in and help teach the families, how to accept help. That's really the first step in intervening with these families. And I think with the privacy and trust issues, families think that they're the only ones who can give good care. The family consultants can develop that personal relationship with them and establish that trust, and they can also respond quickly. Typically within a week, family consultants are able to get these families respite, and so that is another way of establishing that trust. The quality assurance families are taught how to make better decisions, how to choose and evaluate quality services. It also helps with burnout with the families, because the family consultant can encourage and promote self-care. We've had a lot of families who have been connected with the Powerful Tools programs and have learned self-care skills that way. And it's just an empowering relationship between the families and the family consultant. They're able to understand the need for and value of respite, and they receive dementia care training themselves so that they can be more confident and the care that they provide. It helps with accessibility, the isolation. The families are re-engaged into the community. And I think with the crisis intervention is probably one area that we're successful at, but we also need to find a way to, get better in that area, because we can intervene and help the families during a crisis, but we want to find a way to reach them earlier so that, they're getting help before they reach that point. The other thing about North Carolina, I think that, in our state, there's so much focus on, starting things at the community level and then, working up to the state level. It's just kind of a process that we go through. So with Project CARE, that's really the way we had to do things, is to kind of get the community to buy into it first, and that was through, the local outreach kind of consultants, really reaching out to different members of the community, the faith groups, just a real focus on and minority rural outreach. And I think that was the first step. And then once you're providing a good service, then you're going to increase your referrals, and the demand for service is going to increase, because word spreads fast in these small communities, and people have confidence in the program, and they want to see more families helped. I think that it helps for us to involve the community in the program, in the planning and evaluation. We originally had what we called respite impact assessment teams during the first 3 years, and these teams kind of dissolved and are now part of existing committees consisting of county planning committees, caregiver committees for the Family Caregiver Support Program. And to us, that was evidence of the community taking ownership of the program and accepting it as something that they wanted to continue. You know, we've tried all along to get ongoing feedback from families, from providers, you know, to tell us, you know, how, what they like about the program, what's working, you know, what needs to change, and we've, you know, altered things along the way based on their feedback. One of the things that I have to credit Lisa Gleiser and some of the presentations we did in the past, we had panels that included some of the Project Care families and providers, and that was real powerful because it helped us kind of spread the word of how well the program was working and how much it was impacting these families' lives, and just giving real-life examples, I think, you know, was much more powerful than just hearing it from those of us who are implementing the program. And, you know, just enhancing the provider workforce. You know, we've been able to provide a lot of training to provider agencies that are participating in Project Care, and that, in turn, you know, increases the quality of care, customer satisfaction. They're getting more demand for their services and more employment opportunities. So it really benefits everyone who's involved in the program. The next thing I was going to talk about is engaging other groups. And my boss once said to me something about how well we're marketing our program, and I didn't really think of it as marketing, because to me I just felt like, you know, we found something that worked well, and we wanted to spread the word so we could get this program in as many areas as possible. But I guess it does, you know, make sense to label it marketing. You're just doing whatever you can to increase visibility of the program, which, you know, builds trust and respect and confidence and increases demand for the program. And it also increases awareness of caregiver issues and Alzheimer's disease.
So Lisa, could you also talk a little bit about some of the, how you think some of the recognition that you've received kind of has played into things, and some of your partnerships?
Sure, sure. That was actually the next thing I was just going to mention is, in, you know, through a lot of the marketing we did, through, you know, having different articles published and presenting in state and national conferences, some of the things that have come out of this, in last year, we presented at the, it was the NCOA ASA conference, and one of the things that came out of that was there was somebody in the audience who really liked what they heard about the program, and we ended up applying for a, there was a competitive, I guess you could call it a competition, but they had different programs apply, and we received an award for our geriatric best practices, and in turn, we presented at a geriatric best practices conference, which was the Southeast region, and, you know, received recognition for that. This year, just about a month or so ago, we received a national program Clearinghouse Award through the Alzheimer's Association, and you know, that's just, I think, as I said, when, you know, starting at the community level, it kind of trickled upwards, and, you know, getting the word out, we were able to get these recognitions for how well the program was doing, and I think that just kind of alerted people in, on the state level, that this is something that really has potential for making a difference in our state, and it's not just a short-run program. You know, it's something that, you know, we feel, if it's, you know, parallel with the Family Caregiver Support Program, you know, providing the dementia-specific element, that it could be, you know, what our state needs to prepare for, you know, the future, you know, with the population changing and all of that that we're aware of. So it's helped us receive support, and it's increased our partnership activities. You know, we've received private grants from different foundations, the KB Reynolds, Sisters of Mercy, and we also received some funds from the Attorney General's office for a pharmaceutical settlement. And it hasn't been a lot of money, but it's really helped our expansion efforts. We were trying to expand our program with no increase in funds, and it also helps us serve families that are on a waiting list. We received some support from the AAA, some home and community care block grant funding, some funding from the Family Caregiver Support Program, you know, for more respite through Project Care. And there's just been kind of a lot of things that have happened recently that, you know, we hadn't anticipated. Just probably a couple last things is, you know, we had an article in the North Carolina Medical Journal, which they, the Institute on Aging, decided to do a whole issue on Alzheimer's disease, and that, you know, came out of a lot of different things, part of which, you know, was our partnership with the Family Caregiver Program, and that one of the editors for that journal was on the Family Caregiver Steering Team, and so a lot of the planning evolved out of that. We are going to be working with the UNC Institute on Aging and Duke Family Support Program to try to get more of a policy focus in the next year or two. So they're going to be doing some research and trying to come up with some legislative recommendations. So that's kind of the direction that we're going in. And you know, I could go on, but for the sake of time, I'll end there to give some time for questions.
You don't want to get a reputation like me.
Well, thank you both very much. This is Diane. And, you know, thank you for taking the time to do that. And for everyone on the phone, I just wanted to share that part of the reason that I was excited to have both Romaine and Carissa do these presentations, because they are examples of successful examples of sustainability, but two completely different models, with Romaine having basically built her product, her program, with a very consistent focus on the caregiver, on other existing programs and piggyback on them. And on the other flip side of that example, Carissa sort of building a program from the grassroots level up and then almost spreading it through the state. So thank you, and I'll turn it back to Chris.
Okay. Yeah, thank you both again for sharing your sustainability insights. And I guess what we'd like to do now is open the floor for the remainder of the hour for questions for Carissa and Romaine. And I'd also, you know, just briefly like to ask that you identify your name and state before you ask your question. So, you know, as the spirit moves you, feel free.
This is Pearl Bouchard from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. I'll fill in the dead air. I'd like to hear a little bit more talk about the approach with the private foundations. A lot of times they're looking for new and different ideas, and if you've already been operating for 3 years, what might be a way that you've approached the foundations to make it fit with that concept of new and different?
I think that goes to Carissa.
Really, the key with the foundations that we've worked with is that they were looking for programs to fund that helped the targeted populations that we were working with. They wanted to reach out to rural areas, minority groups, and you know, yes, we had been in existence for a while, but it was still a fairly new program. And I guess, you know, with the success that we've had, you know, they had confidence that, you know, we were going to meet the needs of the communities that they wanted to help. So that, you know, is really what made it work. You know, I think that the partners that we have, you know, are pretty reputable in the areas, and so, again, you know, they had the trust and confidence that they would accomplish what they were proposing to accomplish. So we just didn't have, you know, it wasn't a whole lot of money, so, you know, we still are making ongoing efforts to try to secure, you know, additional sources of money, because probably our biggest challenge has been, you know, we don't have enough money to meet the demand for the services. So, you know, every little bit helps, that's for sure. But, you know, that's really what I can tell you, is that they were looking for a minority and rural outreach effort, and that's what we were doing, so it matched well.
Next question. Don't be shy.
This is Romaine. It's not a question, but maybe just another point of clarification that I've observed in Maine is that the people that we work with who become our partners, and it's who we fund and give them money, they become the best advocates for sustainability. So in some ways, I don't really have to do it, because they've seen the real difference in their programs or in people's lives, so that they become the best, they really become the advocates for sustainability.
So who would you, to give us some examples of who that might be.
How do you select those programs?
Well, I can go back in time a little bit and, let me just talk about the Caregiver Companion Program. That program is something we started, on a very small scale. And we hired 3 part-time caregiver companions who were the ones who went out into people's homes and actually worked with the caregivers of people who are caring for somebody receiving home care. And they saw the need that they were in their home and they could see the need these caregivers have for basic information and education about the disease process or how to help with communication or behavior problems. And as I said, these are not particularly skilled people, licensed people, but they're people who have a lot of background in caregiving and have a lot of tenacity, and they just work with these caregivers. And they think it's the best program in the world because they know they're meeting a need. They know what they're doing, and they see that they are able to relieve stress and how welcomed they are into homes just by the little that they're able to offer. That's the group that came to me and basically said, we've got to evaluate this program. They wanted a formal evaluation because they wanted to be able to demonstrate in a quantitative way the benefit their benefit so that it could be expanded to a statewide program. So they're the ones who are asking. It's not me saying, oh, this is such a great program, and these are the reasons why. They're the ones who are saying, they're convincing me how the value of it and actually wanting to show in a quantitative way the benefit in terms of reducing caregiver stress burden and depression. So the programs at the Area Agency on Aging level, with the RESPA program, when we started that out, they each had a different model. And, it was done differently at each Area Agency on Aging. We just had the approach if what you're doing isn't working, that's fine. Go back to the drawing board and try something that does work. And so that's how we kind of evolved to some models that really worked, and then we made that a statewide program. And then that was what was eventually picked up with state funding at close to $600,000. And again, it sounds like it's somewhat similar to North Carolina in that the RESPA program, most of that RESPA is provided by a family, neighbor, and friend at a choice. They'd rather hire a family, neighbor, or friend rather than go to an agency because it's a known person. It's somebody they trust. And they have control.
It's actually... we've been piloting the private respite option, just as of July of this year, 2004. But we've only actually had 2 or 3 families that selected that option. And it's probably just different because we have more resources available through agencies, and with Maine, probably don't have that many resources available. So it really depends in each area. But we really haven't had that much, that many requests for it.
That is interesting.
Next question.
Can I say something?
Yes, you may.
This is Lori. I think it speaks to the importance of, while it's really very, very helpful to hear how other states have done it, it speaks to the importance of sort of understanding the strengths and the needs within your own communities so you can build on those strengths to fill what needs you can. And, to toot the horn of the program, the one thing that everybody always says is the flexibility is the key. And as Romaine commented, you know, they had it going different programs in different sites, and they had to kind of go, this doesn't work. And believe you me, I hear that a lot, and it's really very, it's kind of an unrealistic environment sometimes, in that you can call it and go, this isn't working, and it's like, okay, then how to make it different, and you can really make those have the leisure of making mistakes, if you will, or learning from mistakes and rearranging and moving forward with. Oftentimes, and I think that's a component of the program that it's hard for some people outside of the program to understand, because it's not how, in my limited understanding, how most grant programs work. Sort of like, this is what you're going to do, and this is what we expect to make it happen. And so I think one of the strengths I hope you also hearing from these conversations is it didn't just all fall into place overnight, and so there's a lot of lessons learned and valuable tools I think that both Risa and Romaine can offer, not just from the success but from the obstacles they had to overcome to get there and that sort of thing.
We're kind of doing that right now with the mental health services, because as I pull the project grantees together and we talked, and we meet periodically, they all talked about the level of depression, the clinical depression of caregivers. So that's why we decided to use some of the demonstration grant funds to allow them to do something with mental health. And each agency that, or each partner that we're working with, is doing it differently. Not one is doing the same thing.
Right.
And we come together. The first meeting we had, we came together, and we had a little consultant come in and talk about how to approach somebody who you think is depressed. We were starting at a level where people really didn't even know how to have that conversation. So we had somebody from a mental health agency come in and talk about that. But each of the partners are developing different programs, and when we come together, they talk about what's working and what isn't. And we're at various stages of implementation. But I have the sense that, as we move along, while they may look very different now, they'll probably come together and look very similar at the end. But they each have to kind of build their own community support for that program, or develop their own relationships with mental health agencies, or however they're going to approach it, so that whatever they do will work in their region.
Okay.
I have a question first for Teresa and Diane, simply because I see it's something you mentioned, and then for Romaine if you want to sort of follow up on it. But when you were talking about your key partners, you also sort of talked about linking in with the Real Choice System Change Grants and the Aging and Disability Resource Centers. And I was just wondering if you could just describe a little bit in greater detail, how those relationships are working.
It's really a lot easier than I anticipated. Probably like some other people, when we received the RFP last spring, I was like trying to figure out, how we were going to do this, because it was programs that I really hadn't, I didn't have a whole lot of knowledge about at the time. So it was kind of a crash course in the whole application process. But once we had meetings, and it was, primarily, I met with the project directors for these programs originally, and that's how it started, just having discussions and brainstorming about, how our programs could collaborate, where our goals overlap. And then once things got started, it just made so much sense. With the Real Choice Grant, there's a lot of different aspects of that program, and we just selected two that related to Project CARE. And for the Consumer Directed Care Work Group, it was a easy fit, and they're trying to get people to try, what Maine is doing, and allowing families to hire private respite workers. And so they're doing a lot of research and developing tools for that. And that helps us, what we're trying to do. And the Direct Care Workers Association, again, it was just, a pretty easy fit. Their focus is on the direct care worker, and that just enabled us to have more support and resources for our respite providers. And with the Aging and Disability Resource Center, that is, as I said, it's fairly new, and it's in only two of our counties, Forsyth and Surrey. So what they're doing now is just kind of getting started and developing a statewide information and assistance, you know, computerized base, and trying different tools such as a centralized, you know, client intake form. And we're sort of, I guess, they're guinea pigs for that. We're helping in, you know, test these tools, and we're also trying to get information for their computer system, and so that there's enough information about dementia resources that can help families. And it's just, I guess, as I said before, it made so much sense once we got started, where, you know, we're both, it's a mutual relationship, we're helping each other, and it just works really well. And I think the timing is good, because there's so many things going on right now, you know, aiming for systems change, and so, you know, we all pull our resources together, and hopefully, you know, we'll make more progress that way.
Maybe do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I just, this is interesting how these things evolve, but with our Aging and Disability Resource Center grant, we kind of considered how we could integrate with that. And I became a member of their steering committee, so I would go to those meetings and you just kind of listen. And then all of a sudden it occurred to me, as you listen to these discussions that we've all had, that people who, many of the people who are approaching the ADRC are actually not the people who have the need, but the family member or the caregiver who. And so I just kind of raised the question of whether they would be willing to add a few questions when people approach the ADRC for information about whether they're caring for somebody who is not in good health or is not managing well, or whether they're seeking information on behalf of another person, you know, or seeking services on behalf of another person. And then kind of if they say yes, and then adding another, like two questions, and then referring them directly to the Area Agency on Aging, where there is a respite program, or that has has support for the person with Alzheimer's or their and/or their family caregiver. So everybody, it was amazing how everybody was agreeable to that. There was like hardly any discussion, but yet it had been completely overlooked. So I would say my role in that is relatively small. But it was like a reminder, and just kind of somebody there saying, look, you need to address these needs as well. And so it was very easy to incorporate.
Well, great. Thank you.
We have time for one more question. Anything?
Can you hear us out here in Idaho?
We can hear you out there in Idaho. We just need to know who we're hearing.
Okay. This is Abby McLean in Boise, Idaho.
Abby, Diane.
Hi, Diane. Yeah. We were listening to this, and I guess I just want to get some clarification on, it sounds like both North Carolina and Maine have a lot of funds available for families to use for respite. And are those all state funds? Is it, where is all that money coming from?
Well, for Maine, we started with federal funds.
Okay.
We only used the Alzheimer's Demonstration Grant funds. That's it. And that's what I'm saying. We kind of built the model. We tested mm-hmm. models and built the model and came up with one that worked. And then that has now been picked up and is funded by the state.
And what about in North Carolina? You
it doesn't seem like a whole lot of money to me. We do have the federal funds and the state match that provides, you know, the bulk of what we use for respite services, and we have received some additional funds through the Area Agency Agencies on Aging through their Family Caregiver Support Program and Home and Community Care Block grant funding, which usually is the end of the year. Anything that they haven't spent, you know, then they'll give it to us. So it's a little bit, you know, we can't always count on it. But then the private foundations have helped some. But, you know, to us, you know, we're able to serve the 10 counties that we have. But in order to go from 10 to 100, which is how many counties we have in North Carolina, you know, we have a long way to go to secure that level of funding. But, you know, we're hoping to move in that direction.
This is Heather from Washington, D.C. I just wanted to know, did you have any opportunity to include faith community in your efforts to reach out to people with respite needs?
Is that question?
Who's that for?
That for?
Either.
Whoever can answer it.
Well, I'll tell you, our best success in doing that has been through the Brookdale Funds Developing Respite Programs.
Mm-hmm.
They've been very eager to. I mean, it's limited, but some of those programs have been very successful, and that has been done through the churches.
Mm-hmm.
I think for North Carolina, it's been some of our work with Faith in Action, and probably more so our work with the Support Team Network, and that has been mostly faith groups, but it also involves hospice and end of life and the AAAs. That's a volunteer-based respite program, and whenever possible, you know, we try to help families who are on our waiting list, you know, through that resource. So it's always been a priority for us to involve the faith community, especially, you know, in the areas that we're working in. They play a pretty important role, and they also help us identify the families that are in need of these services.
Lori, did you want to say something about when some additional information on some of those programs I just mentioned might be available?
Yep, I did. I wanted to say, what did I want to say? About, well, distracted.
Brookdale funds are available now. Is that what you were referring to, Diane?
Right, but the programs, not talking specifically about faith-based. That's why I got confused.
Now, what I was talking about is I would point out is that some of the other products that the Technical Assistance Resource Center is trying to provide to the grantees on the line is more information about some of these projects. And I know we've put together the information, but I leave it in A or the A's hands to sort of describe when it might be available to people online. That's what I was driving at.
Okay, I'm sorry. I kind of didn't understand. Well, what I, going out of order is that, and not necessarily related to the specific question Tony just asked, but I wanted to say that one of the things we're doing in conjunction with the Resource Center is we're going to be conducting some case studies over the summer, and actually Maine and North Carolina are two of the five states that we'll be looking to for information, more in-depth information about how they were able to embed some of these programs or expand on them with them, you know, considering some of the limited resources that can be available at times, and we're again talking about obstacles and barriers and overcoming them and the lessons learned. And I hope that in this case, in terms of the case studies, we'll have some final product on that by the early fall that will give really sort of hands-on information about, you know, this is what happened, this is what they did, and it is my intent that they'll have direct applicability to other states or programs, not just necessarily Alzheimer's program. And one of the products that's on my desk here somewhere is that the Resource Center has put together and should be going up on the website as soon as we get all the links merged and get in with our web people, is an annotated bibliography of volunteer respite programs and resources. It's going to be an online guide, and I think it's really great. It talks about Faith in Action and North Carolina's project, the Brookdale Foundation's respite programs, support teams, which is something that are among others, our Alabama project working, utilizing, I think, North Carolina. That's from what you do too, right? The support teams. You know, just a variety of things, training manuals that they've identified, from like Interfaith Caregiver Alliance and et cetera. So I think, and when that does go up, we'll send something out over our listserv, and we'll have it in the What's New section of the Alzheimer's Research Room.
All right. Thank you, Lori. As promised, we're trying to keep these to an hour, so I'd like to thank Carissa and Romaine for giving us a lot to think about.
Yay, thank you.
And I'd like to, you know, thank you all for attending, and also I think on that What's New section of AOA's website, hopefully in the next couple of days, Lori can correct me if I'm wrong, there will be a recording of this teleconference, so
yes.
People, you know, if you want to share with friends or relive the good times, we'll be there. available to you.
I'm sorry, Chris. This is Donna Wahlberg. I thought 2 o'clock Minnesota time and didn't make the translation.
That's okay, Donna.
Will it be an audio?
Yes, it is an audio file.
Great. So I hear actually everything you just said.
Everything.
That's super.
Except my song.
I'm hearing your question right now. So.
Oh, good.
And if for anyone else who just chimed in, that is also the case. So it will be available to you as an audio file, thanks to our good friends at In Meetings. Unless there are any other issues from Lori or Diane, my name is Chris, and for AOA's ADDGS Resource Center, I'd like to thank you for attending. We'll be doing this, like Lori said, on a monthly basis for the next few months, and we hope you join us for those as well.
Thanks, everyone.
Have a great afternoon.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.